Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, I'm your host. On today's show, John Anderson is back here in the guest seat. It should be interesting. Do stay tuned. John, thanks again for joining me here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
It's going to be an eventful fall here. In the media landscape, especially in the regulatory landscape.
Yeah, and especially on the radio side of things.
Especially on the radio side of things, because we have in the offing a potential for full power educational,
non-commercial
FM licenses, which I've talked about a bunch in the last few months here on the Media Geek Show.
Right.
That's kind of a big deal. As well, always going on in the background is the ownership, media ownership proceeding, which is sort of rambling on.
Yes.
Interminably, it seems.
Right.
But the FCC will be in our backyard very shortly here in Illinois, up in Chicago.
Yeah, Thursday, September 20th.
Yeah, you said from 4 to 11 p.m.
4 to 11 p.m. They're going to be holding a seven-hour-long hearing, and you know it's going to go longer than that.
That is marathon.
Yeah. Well, the way these things usually work is the FCC tends to bundle a public hearing with a regular meeting. So the FCC is pretty much statutorily mandated to meet once a month if they have active business to decide, and they usually do. So what they've decided to do is for their September 20th meeting is to hold a regular meeting first, which will probably happen at 4 o'clock. And then the way that these public hearings have worked in the past is they devote a couple of hours to kind of a quasi-experts yammering about crap from the point of view of people that actually work within the industry. So you have journalists, station owners, newspaper publishers from the local community, as well as possibly a media studies professor or a journalism professor from the local college. And they get up there and they have a couple of panels talking about the state of the media environment, localism, diversity, and journalism. And it's all very flowery language. And it's kind of like one of those kabuki plays where everyone's got their role and everyone's got their costume and they make the grandiose gestures which are required by their character, and then after that, the real fun starts, which is the public hearing section. And the way that that works is when you show up to one of these hearings, you essentially sign up on a piece of paper with all of your name and address information, and then the FCC gives you 2 whole minutes to stand in front of all 5 commissioners and have your say. And this has been done. This will be the 5th official public hearing on media ownership that the FCC's held, and they promised to hold at least 6. And at each one of these, the time which they say they're going to end by has never been subscribed to. It's always gone longer. In some places, there have been people that waited in line for a couple hours before the meeting even started just to sign up. And then there are people that have waited 6 to 8 hours in line to actually testify. And as far as the FCC is concerned, the commissioners themselves, the two Democrats, Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, have been very adamant about making a show of staying and listening to the public. So while the Republicans may sneak out at 11 o'clock and decide to go back to their hotel rooms, there will at least be the minority of commissioners who will stick around and listen to everything, and everything that is filed or said at one of these public hearings goes directly into the media ownership record, which is really big now because another development that we haven't mentioned, and it's something that I have to catch up on, is the fact that the FCC, a couple of months ago, earlier on in the summer, released their major media ownership
studies.
That's
right. I haven't had a chance to catch up with them yet either.
Right.
Although I've not heard anything good about them.
No, and the fact that the FCC was only giving something like 2 to 3 months, maybe 4 max, to actually analyze all of the data, the raw data, analyze the conclusions that were made by the people that put the studies together, and then file comments. It's really hard for anybody to really do a substantive job in 90 days on top of all the other work that they have to do. So it's an interesting record, and it's shaping up to be a very interesting record. And if the FCC actually promulgates rules, which they could maybe do next year, maybe, although it's an election year, and, you know, I don't know if the FCC, Republican-controlled FCC, looks at this as being a last-ditch effort to possibly get through something that allows more consolidation, or if they will just sit on it because it's too much of a hot potato issue politically. But We're seeing a big record built up, and it'll be interesting to see what the actual rules are that are promulgated. But at this point, it's anybody's guess.
They've certainly drawn it out. I mean, part of it being drawn out is actually holding public hearings this time around.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to be in no particular rush, and there's plenty of other business in front of the commission, including possibly having to look at the SiriusXM merger, which we've talked about in the past.
And there are other proceedings that are going on which tie directly into the media ownership proceedings. Some of the Democratic members of Congress have written to the FCC and said, wait a minute, you promised back in 2002, 2003 that you would actually study the concept of localism, and you promised to hold a series of hearings around the country on localism in media, and you shouldn't make any rules on media ownership until you've finished that sub-proceeding on localism, and the FCC is still kind of dragging their feet on that. A few months ago, they did hold a localism hearing.
Well, and that was something which Michael Powell kind of threw into the mix, really to throw the scent off of media ownership, right? He tried to make the claim that localism was a separate issue from media ownership and therefore needs to be explored on its own. So I think that was really a smokescreen proceeding that in bringing up localism, but now they're stuck with it. At the same time, while they're working on media ownership again, because the court threw out their original set of new rules.
The court threw out the rules. The political dynamics have changed. Michael Powell managed to piss off at least 3 million Americans, a significant portion of which have actually engaged themselves in this process, and suddenly we're looking at a different ballgame. That doesn't mean to say that I'm optimistic the FCC is going to do something like actually reinstate certain caps on certain media ownership, but it may give them pause. The funny thing about how the FCC works, though, is you have to remember a lot of this stuff's actually written by the staff. And the commissioners are the ones who are most susceptible to political pressure, but it's the staff who are actually writing the language. And so while we can make comments, we're not making comments directly to FCC staff. And when we go to public hearings, we're not making public hearing comments directly to FCC staff. All that is filtered and processed by people who we don't even really know. And the FCC is one of those agencies where it's an expert agency and the expertise does not lie at the top. And the bad thing about this is, of course, is that there's so much revolving door action between the FCC and industry that a lot of these people are looking to write rules in certain ways that may be advantageous to future employers. And I don't really know how we break that cycle. I mean, obviously flooding people with comments and beefing up the record with actual bona fide public interest feedback is good, but I don't really know how much that will actually change anything, but that's just the cynic.
Yeah, well, that's the capture effect, which you see across regulatory agencies, whether it's the FCC or the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency.
Wow. Or the Interstate Commerce Commission.
The Interstate Commerce Commission, that's right. Regardless of the agency, you're going to see that same capture effect of people moving back and forth from industry and regulation and, having the difficulty of separating the interests of the public from the interests of the industry. It's like the old adage, what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because unlike a lot of other areas, like people who work in Congress technically have to take some time off before they can actually go work for an industry client.
Unless you're Billy Towson.
Right, and then, you just kind of go to pharma and tell everyone to, deal with it. But in the FCC, the time between leaving the FCC and actually joining, the National Association of Broadcasters, for example, as one of their principal lobbyists can be as short as 6 weeks. Someone will retire at the end of the month, and they'll start at the end of the next month or the beginning of the month
because
after that.
They know the ins and outs.
They know the
ins
and outs.
They still got friends.
And it's suddenly, it's interesting if you follow that kind of thing to see who these names are. For example, there is a pending petition for rulemaking in front of the FCC, which would allow AM stations to apply for FM translators. The National Association of Broadcasters says that the AM band is so beleaguered by interference that they need to use FM spectrum in order to maintain their coverage areas and keep their viability economically speaking. Well, the two authors of that petition for the NAB were senior staff members in the FCC's media bureau.
And the bureau which oversees radio.
Right, and one of the first things they did when they got to the NAB was they wrote this darn petition. And, in a way, that seems kind of traitorous to me. How could you do that? I know you want a house and two kids and a nice private school, but damn it. I mean, do you not have a conscience? Anyway, Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Now.
That's all right. So, going back to the FCC being in Chicago now in a week or so from when we're recording this, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make it up, though I've been thinking about it. It just, the time keeps creeping along.
Oh, wait. We might have to edit this. I think it's 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Because today is the 5th. Thursday is the
6th. We're recording this on the 5th of of September. You're probably hearing it later.
Yeah.
So what's the date again in which it's...
September 20th.
September 20th, yeah.
So it's 2 weeks.
Oh, well, that just clears everything up for me then.
Sorry.
I don't need to edit it out. No, that's fine. They need to know that we're fallible here, John.
All right.
Despite being radio gods, we occasionally get our dates wrong.
No, I'm just trying to be...
September 20th. So that might, there's a little bit of time for me to get my things lined up to be able to take the trek to Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be webcast or broadcast at all.
In the past...
I wonder if CAN TV might be doing it.
That
which
might
is the Chicago Access Network.
That's a very good idea. I know that our good friends at Chicago Media Action, which is kind of an umbrella media reform group in Chicago, are organizing pretty heavily around this, and they have contacts with CAN TV. In the past, the FCC has actually put together a pretty crappy audio-video stream, like pretty low bitrate, real audio-only.
They're like
stream.
Using like the circa 1998 codecs
yeah.
there. I don't
and
know
they only
what's
have
up with
one
that.
Really bad jazz CD, which they play as filler music, and, you know, that's what you get. But
you know, I think they need to get the Herbie Hancock Headhunters CD.
Ah, yes.
I think that would be a good improvement.
Some of that music is coming back with a vengeance. The other interesting thing that you might notice, and we could see in Chicago, is that suddenly the local media get interested about serving the public. In the last at least two previous media ownership hearings, the local media suddenly made this big stink about, well, we're going to webcast it too. Tune to our local TV station and we'll be webcasting it, you know, uncensored and everything will be just fine. And we're sending reporters on. We'll have team coverage on our news at 5 for a day. And then it will be gone again. So even if the FCC's crappy web stream isn't working for you, there is a possibility that one of the larger stations in Chicago would do something. I would be very interested, and maybe I'll just make this a prediction, that Tribune may try to make hay out of this.
Well, Tribune certainly has a dog in that race,
mm-hmm.
Since they're trying to sell off their broadcast stations to a Chicago-based billionaire.
Right.
But in so doing, the FCC has to review its grandfathered ownership of a television station and a newspaper
in
contradiction to the cross-ownership rule, which still exists, but which Tribune has been lobbying heavily for many years now to be done away with.
Right. And so it will be interesting to see if possibly they somehow try to leverage this opportunity to show that what they're doing is good for the public and that they should be allowed to proceed with their sale, and that cross-ownership hasn't really been that bad for everybody. Look, Chicago's still standing. You know, we didn't destroy the media landscape by having a TV station and a newspaper.
You know, and then that's, is like the third largest media market.
Sure, you know.
You know, where you do have an actual competing newspaper, the Sun-Times, which competes with the Chicago Tribune. I think you have a little more of an escape valve.
Yeah.
Lets the pressure off, but if you were talking about even just down the road to St. Louis or to Indianapolis or Madison or Milwaukee, I don't think you'd be talking about nearly the same sort of media diversity. And even Chicago is not as diverse as it once was.
And that will be the interesting thing to see also how the local media in Chicago portray the public feedback that happens at these hearings. One of the things which the National Association of Broadcasters and its member stations have started to spin when they start to cover these localism hearings is, geez, all these people not from Chicago are going to show up. You know, there's going to be people from Wisconsin or Minnesota that are going to drive to Chicago to talk to the FCC, and how dare they do that? Because this hearing is being held in Chicago. Knock, knock, excuse me, the normal citizen rarely gets a chance to actually speak. So if a hearing is within a few hundred miles, people from surrounding states are going to come, and they have just as much of a right to speak at that venue as anybody
else.
Well,
because they're not holding 50 hearings, one per state.
So, these are all things that we should kind of keep an eye out for as coverage of the event starts to break in the mainstream media and some of the angles we could see how it will be portrayed.
And that will only happen about a week in advance.
Right.
And as you mentioned, it will be evaporated within 2 days afterwards.
Yeah.
Because even when media ownership turns up as a story in the mainstream media, it's almost never longitudinal. It's almost never something which is covered as an ongoing story of ongoing import. It's covered as something which has these occasional events, like a hearing, like an ownership hearing, but not something which goes on and on, or even, you know, it is of ongoing import outside of these punctuated events. And that's kind of the one of the big problems with the way the mainstream media covers itself, or covers regulation and ownership. The other problem being that it will be covered as a business story. Mm-hmm. It'll be covered in the business section, and you won't hear so much about the word democracy unless they choose to quote somebody, someone making public comment who uses that word.
Yeah, or you'll see a tone of self-deprecation.
Right.
Where, you know, if you really hate the stuff we publish on our editorial page, here's your chance to actually say something about it. Hardy har har, you know, and then they can say that they've actually informed you, but they've done it in a completely tongue-in-cheek way that, you know, pre-marginalizes whatever it is you're going to say.
Right. Well, this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel. I'm your host. And today, John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, former producer of Media Minutes, is joining me here, taking a look a little bit at what's going on at the FCC this fall as we rev up for another big regulatory season, and maybe picking up the hood and taking a look at what's going on underneath and seeing whether the camshafts are kept clean.
Still a mess down there.
It's still kind of a mess down there. Still, it sure is.
Still needs some WD-40.
And you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net for the not-so-updated blog.
It's
right
getting
now.
There.
It's getting there. And, of course, the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments, send them to me, Paul, at MediaGeek.net. Well, so amongst the things going on at the FCC, one of them is fairly positive in that there's a potential for some new non-commercial FM stations, full power even.
Yes.
All the way up to maybe even as much as 100,000 watts.
It could very well be possible.
It's not going to happen in most major metroplexes.
It's not going to happen hardly in any major metroplexes.
Not even the metroplex of Champaign, Urbana, Central Illinois.
No. In fact, there are no open frequencies, according to the FCC, for us in our little burg, but in places like the southwest suburbs of Chicago.
Places that didn't used to be suburbs.
Right, that I guess were exurban and are now suburban, you know, are way far out of the metropolitan area itself. And primarily rural areas are going to have the opportunity to apply, and it could be what may very well be the last major opportunity to get an influx of non-commercial educational radio stations on the air. I mean, the FCC still has the opportunity to possibly open up another filing window for small 10-watt LPFM radio stations. And there are bills pending in Congress, companion legislation pending in the House and Senate, that would effectively overturn the damage Congress did to low-power FM and subsequently open up more markets for stations. That being said, those are all things that are relying on political dynamics and chances, and, you know, it's kind of a... What's the word I'm looking for here? Not Rubik's Cube. the Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah.
It's kind of like one of those Rube Goldberg...
It's like mousetrap.
...systems where if this happens and then this falls into this slot and then falls down this chute and then makes something happen and shocks the mouse, we'll get low-power FM.
Right.
You know? But this is actually an opportunity which is going to be existing right now. In fact, in October, the FCC will open up a long-awaited filing window for non-commercial full-power FM radio stations. And there have been a lot of interested people and groups. Now, they're only going to give licenses to groups, so you have to be an incorporated not-for-profit group. And you have to go through a lot more paperwork and a lot more engineering work to get a full-power FM station.
And you have to have a lot more money in your coffers.
Yes.
You have to be able to prove that you can actually build the station once you get the construction permit.
For a specific amount of time and things like that. And so it takes a lot more effort, a lot more upfront investment, but it is an opportunity that several members, I guess, of what we've come to call the public interest artist community in shorthand, have mobilized around the Prometheus Radio Project, the Pacifica Foundation, Public Radio Capital, which is a group that actually helps public radio stations build out infrastructure, Free Press. They've all kind of mobilized and have reached out to various constituencies within the larger social justice movement, labor unions, environmental organizations, groups like that, in order to get them to sponsor one of these full power FM station applications. And from last count, from what I've heard, at least one group alone is working with something like 300 applicants.
Wow.
So that is a pretty good response. So we're going to see a lot of people filing a lot of applications, and a lot of these people are going to be bona fide grassroots community-minded media activists, which I think is a really, really good sign. The problem is that the FCC is still debating what the conditions of the application round are going to be. So one of the main things they have yet to figure out is how many stations can one group apply for.
Right, and that's a really important, contingency, as we saw with the auctioning off of translator stations for not in the nonprofit sector a number of years ago, where we had these large Christian groups get awarded hundreds of construction permits for these translator repeater stations. And certainly these same groups have a lot of resources at hand to flood the FCC with applications during this non-commercial window as well.
Yeah, Paul. Well, one of the things you're mentioning is something that happened in 2003. And since 2003, several large evangelistic religious broadcasters have essentially flipped the construction permits for these smaller stations into cash by selling them to other established broadcasters. They've made millions of dollars doing so. What do you think they were making those millions of dollars for? They were doing that in order to raise money to build full power radio stations. In fact, one of the prime movers behind this, what we call the Great Translator, Great Translator Invasion of 2003, a guy by the name of Clark Parrish, said that, the translators are the horses. The full power stations are the chariots. So we've got our bands of horses now. We just need chariots to hook them to. And so he's actually gone into this as a long-term process. And, you know, Lord knows, pardon my language, that Clark Parrish has probably already written an application to parse open frequencies, prepare the applications for filing, to do some of the preliminary engineering work. And as soon as that five-day filing window opens, he is going to hit the books and hit the FCC hard with applications, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands, in communities all around the country.
And I think partially also to get these stations on the air, but then also to sell them off to other like-minded religious organizations.
Very well could be. And in a case where you have mutually exclusive applications, meaning there's two applicants for one frequency, we get into a weird situation where the FCC starts to consider contingencies of the group and how the group is structured and how solvent the group may be. And if someone like Clark Parrish walks up with 1.6 million and says, look, I can build this station tomorrow and run it for 2 years, no problem, there's a good chance that that might preempt a local group. And the FCC hasn't actually set the rules for, you know, whether or not they're going to give preference to a local group over a distant
applicant. That's right. It's not like low-power FM,
which
gives preference to local groups in the non-commercial full-power station situation. It just, there is no necessarily local preference,
right.
But that's something they are considering. The other thing they're considering, the FCC, is putting a limit on the number of applications.
Ten stations per applicant, although one of the potential ways they might write this regulation is they could say you can file more than 10 applications, but if we decide to approve 10 applications, you're going to have to choose which ones, which is kind of like cherry picking.
I kind of thought, well, and one of the ways they're talking about doing it as well would just be the first 10 that you file.
That's another option,
which seems
a
lot fairer.
But I think that even if a group wants to apply for 10, that's a little bit too much.
Right, and especially if they allow the cherry picking, it would allow someone to flood the agency with 100 applications. Hoping that they could cherry pick the 10 best in sort of the largest markets or in the tastiest areas to put up a new station.
Right. So the FCC has officially closed comment on how they should structure the rules for this spectrum allocation on September 6th. and they will spend the next month or so processing through these comments. It's still possible to file comments with the FCC on this, even if the deadline is passed. It will be entered into the record, and you can actually file this in a handy-dandy web form that you can look to off of either getradio.org or freepress.net. Both of them are working very hard on educating people about the opportunities involved in this filing window, and also educating people to get involved in helping to set the rules that are going to govern this filing window.
But in a lot of ways that people probably don't realize is that a full power FM radio license, non-commercial, is very valuable in cash money.
Yes.
In areas like Washington, D.C., they go for millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah,
even if they aren't commercial licenses, they nevertheless have a lot of value.
And even in a place where you might be broadcasting to more chipmunks than people, the dollar value of a fallow construction permit can easily be in the five-digit range. You know, considering that the amount of money that you're probably going to spend on the engineering and things like that is going to be less than $10,000, or at most $10,000, to put your application together. The filing of the application itself is free because it's a non-commercial station application. So you spend $10,000, you get a construction permit, and then maybe you sell it for $50,000. Not a bad day's work.
No, you can see there's a lot of opportunity for speculation here, like there was with the translator, which required even less engineering and less investment in order to turn those around.
Yeah, so one of the big things that's been going on is trying to mobilize people to put in applications, whether they be original, solo, standalone applications, or competing applications, to what many in the quote-unquote public interest community see as another impending invasion of godcasters looking to basically overwhelm the system with this filing window.
And these godcasters overwhelmingly are not really local stations.
Nope.
They overwhelmingly take a satellite feed, part of a nationwide network of stations, and don't really provide much in the way of local service at all, whereas much of the public interest community is looking to put on community radio stations.
Right, and not to say that the public interest community itself is wholly secular. I mean, they are working with local churches.
And they're working with, like, the United Church of Christ.
Right.
Being one prominent large denomination that's been involved.
Right, and there is a schism, for lack of a better word, within groups like the National Religious Broadcasters over the way to properly evangelize via radio. Most religious broadcasters feel that it should be done on a local basis. You know, you need to kind of be in the middle of the flock you're preaching to. And they don't like what they see as a quote-unquote carpetbagger coming in and doing, pay-for-pray collecting donation work in their backyard using spectrum that they could more fairly use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is kind of a big mess, and it will be interesting to see that the FCC does not screw this one up.
It's interesting to see how ownership counts even when you get outside the commercial media.
Right.
It really has far-reaching impacts, and continuously and overwhelmingly its impact is in local communities, and it really boils down to the question of whether the local community, whether it's secular community, religious community, there's some combination thereof, see themselves or hear themselves in their local media, or whether they're getting a very homogenized nationwide picture that is beamed in, and also sucking the dollars out.
Amen.
And so John Anderson, his website's DIYmedia.net for your micro radio pirating news, as well as other things having to do with our media environment, and a big pile of truthful translations.
We're nearing 500.
Nearing 500.
I think we'll be going past 500 before the year is out.
And I've played a few on the show in the recent weeks. It's been some good new stuff there. You'll definitely want to check that out. All right, John, thanks.
Thank you.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. KQRP in Salida, California. KRBS in Oroville, California. WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. WTND, Macomb, Illinois. WRFA in Jamestown, New York. CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia. WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia. KWMD, Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska. WBEW in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.